So I'd like to thank you, of course, for this invitation and for Ken's introduction. I'm very happy to give these talks, and it's certainly an honor. I'll try to talk about things which are in the spirit of these activities. And well, basically the talks will be rather, I mean, there will be a relation between the different talks, but it will be possible to follow, I hope, most of these talks without having necessarily attended the previous one. And so today I want to give some kind of an overview of different problems, many problems, some partial results in an area that I have been involved in over the last 10 years, which is qualitative aspects of Hamiltonian PDEs, say the usual Hamiltonian PDEs like Schrödinger wave equation, KdV, and these kinds of things, and also lattice models. And in particular, the use of methods from dynamical systems, for instance, to gather information about the behavior of various types of solutions, more from the again from the qualitative point of view, because basically we want to understand classes of solutions rather than individual solutions, and the problem is to be able to turn the method from classical dynamical systems, which are finite dimensional, into tools that also apply in infinite dimensional phase space. So there is from the point of view of a classical PDE a question that I have been looking at for quite some time without being able to make too much decisive progress on it, which is that of the behavior of higher Sobolev norms. So I hope you can read that. I guess it's okay, yeah? Maybe. That should be fine. So what we are talking about here is a non-empty equation on a bounded domain. For instance, you can think about as periodic boundary conditions. So what do I mean by that? Well, take, for instance, a defocusing equation, where the Hamiltonian will give you an a priori estimate. So you have the Hamiltonian, which is written here. So that gives you an a priori estimate on the H1 norm, assuming that you have a data which is in H1, or let's say to simplify that you have a smooth initial data. Well, you will have from the conservation of the Hamiltonian certainly a control of the H1 norm of the solution for all time. And also what I will assume is that the equation is H1 subcritical, which means that you will in particular have the Cauchy problem, which is locally well posed below H1, in fact, in particular in H1. And what usually happens in such a situation is that the problem is also going to be locally well posed for S larger than 1, but you have the conservation of the H1 norm, and so therefore this local result becomes a global result. This is the usual strategy to get global well posedness of the Cauchy problem. If you have a problem which is H1 subcritical and which is defocusing, and so you get starting from a solution with at time, say, you have an initial data at time t equals 0, which is smooth, you end up with a solution which is going to be smooth for all time. So ut will be in hs for all time. But the question is, what is going to happen when time becomes large? So if s is equal to 1, as I said, you have the bound on the H1 norm, but we don't have a priori bounds when S is larger than 1. So if you have a PDE which is on Rn, you may hope for some kind of dispersive behavior, and if you have dispersion, it means asymptotically you will have something that is nearly linear, and there is essentially no, in that case, there is essentially no problem of possible growth of these HS norms. However, when we are on a bounded domain, there is no room for dispersion, and it could very well be that starting from some initial data which is smooth, this classical data you are, this classical solution you are constructing there is going to grow in HS when time is going to infinity. And so there is some problem there, which is the following. It's to understand, for instance, in the particular example I was describing you here, let me do the following, whether there is such a possible growth for higher Sobolev norms. Again, if you would be in the very specific, in the very special situation of integrable equations, well, if you would, for instance, take, instead of a fourth power, if you would take the second power, this is the Zakharov-Shabbat integrable 1D cubic NLS, and then this issue of growth cannot occur because you have all these conserved quantities in particular. But for that equation, basically the only useful conserved quantities here are the L2 norm and the H1 norm, and below, beyond H1 there is nothing we have. So we don't quite know what is happening there. So problem, if you have a fine HS, S bigger than 1, well, you know UT will be in HS for all time, but could it be that this infinity norm, that this HS norm goes to infinity for time going to infinity? And if yes, of course, the next question is just to know, assuming problem 1 is negative, how fast this HS norm could grow. So, since this is supposed to be a relatively elementary talk, let us try to do something elementary. So, one technique to bound this HS norm is just by a Gronwald type estimate. So, there is a small calculation which is here at the bottom of the page. If I introduce as a quantity depending on time, well, if you can prove that always HS norm is going to be bounded, I mean, I know it's an. This is absolutely right. This is absolutely right. But we have to put it in some kind of a simplified form. People get a sense of what is the problem. So what I mean by that, problem one, is it true that always this HS norm is going to be bounded? Assume that this is not always the case, so there are exceptions for which the HS norm could grow, then question two is, what is the worst that can happen? This is the sense of the question. So what is the worst that can happen? Well, by an elementary Gronwald type estimate, what you're going to get in that situation is a bound on the HS norm, which is, in the worst case, exponential in time. And the way you do that is simply introducing the quantity I of t, which is the square of the HS norm, depending on time, I mean, this is not conserved, and then you get that the derivative of I is going to be controlled by I up to a factor, since we are talking about quintic nonlinearity here, which is controlled by the fourth power of the infinity norm, but then just happens to be, because you are in 1D, that this infinity norm is controlled from the H1 and the L2 norm, so from that inequality you're going to get a bound which is exponential, and this is basically the most simple-minded way of doing that without using much of the structure of that equation at all. Now, the conclusion is that you will have an estimate which is like that. What can be gotten, as far as I know, the best result to date in this direction, which is gotten, by the way, by systems from by methods from dynamical systems, is an estimate which is polynomial, a power of time. In fact, this has been gotten in a variety of equations, but somehow using methods from dynamical systems, The best I can get at the present time is an estimate here for t going to infinity of a bound on Gauss's norm by t at the power s minus 1 over 2, roughly speaking. And anyone who can do better than that, please let me know. Now, this is a relatively simple example where, at least with the Grönwald type estimate, you can do you can prove something. If we consider the equation, the NLS equation, say the cubic NLS equation in 2D, defocusing cubic NLS in 2D, so the analog of the Zakharov-Shabbat but in 2D, which is also supposed to be non-integrable, we can ask the same question. So we have, again, it's a defocusing situation. We have a control of the H1 norm by the Hamiltonian, and we have global existence of classical solutions. Question is, what is going to happen with the higher Sobolev norms? Now, the trouble there is that if you want to estimate the L infinity norm by the H1 norm, you just miss it, because in 2D, you cannot quite estimate the L infinity norm by the H1 norm, but there is a slightly upgraded version of this Grönwald estimate, which is going back to, in fact, the result is due to Brizis and Galloway, where you estimate the L infinity norm, not quite by a constant times the H1 norm, but there is a logarithmic factor there. The effect of that is that you're going to have a derivative of I defined as before, which is not going to be quite bounded by I, but there is a logarithm of I. So that is going to get you bounds which are double exponential. And that's already that is even worse than what we got before. The best result in this situation for the HS growth is t at the power s minus 1. What is the conjecture? Well, I think it is an honest conjecture if you consider slightly more general nonlinearities, you can show that, you can produce examples where there is a slow growth in time, say, even with polynomial, say, with analytic nonlinearities. You can create examples where there is a growth. I don't know how to create such examples when we have polynomial nonlinearities like we are making here. But in any case, what I think should be a rather general statement is that there is a growth which is at most a small power of time. So should grow slower than any power of time. And the only evidence for that, well, like what people often do, if you can't do the nonlinear problem, you do the linear problem. In fact, the idea is that every good nonlinear problem should have at its root, should have some linear problem. So, this is not a bad way of trying things. This is, in fact, the type of question that goes back. There have been various people looking at that, in particular people like Zakharov or Spencer and so on. Tom Spencer. So let's consider a linear Schrödinger equation with a time-dependent potential. So what you would do is that you would just replace your u to the fourth, for instance, or your u square. You would write down vxt, and let's just, if you want to have something which is consistent, let's just assume that v is smooth in x and also smooth in time with uniform bounds in time. The way this was considered by people like Zakharov or Spencer, for instance, is by taking specific behavior in time. For instance, you can look at some kind of random behavior in time, or you can also look at periodic or quasi-periodic behavior in time. But really to state the next result, I don't need to make any assumption about the time behavior except uniform bounds in terms of smoothness. So V is real, of course, this is very important. V is real and satisfies uniform bounds in space and time. And then there is this kind of estimate, which very much is in the line of what I like to prove in general, that you have HS norms which are growing at a very slow rate, slower than any power of time. And what should be observed here is that even with examples which are one-dimensional, so d equals 1, v analytic well, let's say smooth, and you can take a behavior in time, say, which is periodic. So take just a periodic in x, so a periodicity in x, periodicity in t. You can find examples which are going to grow like a logarithm or something like that. So in these examples, you can find you can cook up models which are growing at some very slow rate. Although I should say somehow I don't want to get in on that. The examples are really cooked up examples. It's not truly generic behavior. So what I mean by that is that it's the initial data are chosen in a very specific way to create some resonances with the potential. And it could very well be that if you look more generically in the phase space, you wouldn't have that behavior. And in fact, there are quite a bit of positive theorems there, especially when you have periodic or quasi-periodic behavior in time, but I don't want to get in there. Now, also want to recall this bound from the Drizis-Galloway thing. So you see that it's, so for instance, in that example, it has been improved absolutely dramatically from a double exponential in time to some power of the time. Now, there are examples where one doesn't. So how is this done? What is used, of course, a lot there is the structure of the nonlinearity. Now, in some cases, this has not been done at all, and there is one outstanding question, which is not quite a $1 million question, but which is certainly something that I would expect will have to be understood before, say, perhaps one of the most basic questions there. If we are taking an equation like the 2D Euler equation, well, you have, again, I'd forgotten in Scato, you have a global existence theorem for classical solutions. You get, starting from a smooth initial data, a solution that is going to be smooth for all time. But as far as I know, the double exponential bound on the Sobolev norms, in particular, say, on the H1 norm, this is the best that is known. And it would be definitely, I believe, a major breakthrough to improve on this double exponential bound, because it really would mean that you have to understand more the algebraic structure of this nonlinearity and the intricacies that have to do with the particular structure there. And somehow the belief is that, at least my belief is that, to understand Navier-Stokes, somehow you will have to understand something about the special structure of the nonlinearity. So why not trying Euler equation? Talk about something Hamiltonian, forget about this, about diffusion. Just let's understand the thing with all the Laplacian, and either you make a counterexample there, and then that would be a significant result, or if you would prove that it is true, whatever you understand there about the nonlinearity will be relevant also in 3D, I would expect, and if you can do the Euler equation, then that certainly would allow you to do. Navier-Stokes, I would think. Now, in any case, here in the 2D problem, there is no question about blow-ups. We have the classical existence. It is just a matter of understanding how bad this effect of energy spreading to higher modes can be. So this is just a side remark, and I'm not going to go on in this direction. Well, what I also mentioned was lattice models. Now, the way these problems are handled, of course, is that you pass to Fourier, and then, essentially, because you consider periodic boundary conditions on a bounded domain, you can write equations down in the Fourier coefficients, and then automatically you get a lattice system. Now, these lattice systems has been explored in an independent context by mathematical physicists in the context, for instance, of what is called coupled harmonic oscillators. So what I would consider here is what you may call lattice Schrödinger equations, and I will give a later talk about details of recent research progress on that kind of equations. So here we're having sequences which are indexed by the integers or by a higher dimensional version of it, say z or z square or zd, let's take it z for simplicity. Such a sequence qn would be gotten simply by looking at the Fourier coefficients of the function U in the PD case. But the kind of non-linearity which we are considering here is slightly different. We are considering what is called nearest neighbor, well, or maybe should call it bounded range non-linearities. Here this is an extreme case, of course, which means that in your Hamiltonian, when you're looking at site N, then the non-linearity is only going to involve, such monomials will only involve sites, say, N prime, which are close to N, say, at bounded distance from N. So all these things, well, they go, for instance, back to the 86 paper of Froelich, Spencer, and Wayne in the Journal of Statistical Physics. In particular, you can introduce an object there, which is the nonlinear lattice Schrödinger equation, which is a variant of the linear lattice Schrödinger equation by adding this nonlinearity there. So what is V? Well, typical examples would be to take a potential which is random. So you just take for Vn a sequence of independent random variables. Or you could also take a sequence Vn which is quasi-periodic. For instance, you could take Vn cosine n theta or something like that, right? So these are the most studied models. Certainly in the linear case when delta is equal to zero. Now, what is the delta there? Delta is the lattice Laplacian, and it's defined like that. It is zero everywhere, except there is a mistake there. This is not the maximum, this is the sum here. Except if n and n prime are the same, except for one coordinate, where, say, the difference between nj and nj prime is equal to 1. So if it would be in dimension 1, the matrix representation of the Laplacian would simply be 1 below the diagonal and 1 above the diagonal. So there is a misprint here. This is not the L-infinity distance. Well, you could consider that also, but the usual Laplacian here is the sum. Sorry for that. And one can consider more general models, where the Qn square Qn is replaced by something else. In particular, in this category would fall, for instance, the usual equations, the Landau-Lifshitz equations for classical spin waves that fall in this category and where somehow the results can be applied. So relatively little is known about that in the non-linear case. But what is reasonably well understood, to continue more in the direction of what is done here, this is in fact a very classical topic, which is the linear lattice Schrödinger equations, lattice Schrödinger operators. So I will consider as a Hamiltonian here the Laplacian, epsilon Laplacian plus V. In other words, the delta is equal to zero. So I just put my delta equals zero, then I have a linear equation. So there is there are two important notions there, probably the most important. Well, first of all, what is the physical interest of this model? What you are considering essentially are transport properties in alloys. And the simplest, perhaps the most popular model for that kind of transport phenomena are linear lattice Schrödinger equations. So what is relevant there, since you're talking about transport, so transport is more the dynamical localization. Let me show you the whole transparency. But the first stage before you're talking about dynamical localization is just to understand the spectrum of these guys. So there is an important notion there, which is Anderson localization, which means you have pure point spectrum, so no continuous spectrum, and eigenstates which are exponentially localized. And usually in most proofs, when you do prove the Anderson localization, I will come back on that tomorrow, you get also dynamical localization. So dynamical localization relates to the equation. What it tells you is that if you have at time t equals zero, something which is well localized. So let's take for Q, for instance, we could take at time t equals zero, we could take Q to be the Dirac at zero. We have a lattice here, right? So it's just one side at zero, which is one, say, and then the rest should be zero. So what is now the issue is to see whether this mass is going to stay within a bounded neighborhood of zero or is going to disperse. So if you would express the problem of weak turbulence for PDE in the Fourier mode setting, then that would be exactly the issue, is how fast, if there is, and how fast this dispersion in the lattice version is going to happen. So in order to measure this dispersion, what we put here is a weight. So the evolution is simply given by EATH at a given time t. It's a unitary operator, so the L2 norm is conserved. If we claim dynamical localization, for instance, by saying that the sup over t of this expression is going to remain bounded, what it will tell you in particular is that within a bounded spatial region, you're going to recapture most of this L2 norm. It's not going, you're not going to have a fixed amount of L2 norm that is going to spread to go to infinity. What? No, you can choose anything you want. I mean, this theory is very robust. There are some recent developments there, but roughly speaking, at least the classical solution, scenery is that it doesn't really matter very much. You could put another power here, basically. You can put, and if you have one, you have the others, essentially. And what I should say is that in most proofs, in most proofs of Anderson localization, you will get dynamical localization. By the way, of course, I don't have to point out that if there would be a piece of continuous spectrum, you wouldn't have that phenomenon of dynamical localization, right? So this thing has, okay, so when is this thing true? This thing is not always true. I mean, this is quite an important issue. If we are in the random case, then this is always true, no matter what is epsilon in d equals 1. And for higher d, it is always true if epsilon is small, or if you prefer, if the disorder v is large. There are a number of conjectures there. What one believes is that in 2d, for the random case, no matter what is epsilon, you're still going to have localization, but starting from 3d, when you're getting into the bulk of the spectrum, that you may have AC spectrum, so you would have spreading. And this is not quite a $1 million question, but it is on the same level of importance. So this is for the random case. I will discuss you some instances of the random case where there has been recent progress, which is that of the Anderson-Bernoulli model, because there is some nice interference there with PDEs, unicontinuation, so on, in the third lecture. What I want to do next time is to talk about one thing that has been reasonably well developed, which is the quasi-periodic case. So if we are in the quasi-periodic case, then you have, for epsilon small, a complete theory if you are in dimension, lattice dimension d equals 1 or 2, and actually there are many of the techniques which are in this quasi-periodic case that are absolutely essential to discuss certain issues. In nonlinear PDE, say, especially developments of KM theory. In any case, this is for the linear case. This is for the linear situation. The problem is what is happening in the, if you're going back to these lattice models in a nonlinear case, what can be said there? So essentially, you have the counterpart of the questions I was raising for nonlinear PDEs. These problems, they go back to the paper of Froehlich, Spencer, and Wayne. Is there a nonlinear counterpart of localization? Well, I can tell you there is. It would be nice just to have a counterexample where you see, say, that you have some kind of nonlinear absence of localization for exactly the models which are described there, not for some. If you want to do modifications, you can make examples, but just for the model as it discussed there. And then, well, what is the analog of the growth of the HS norm, of course? Well, it would be an estimate on diffusion where, like you say, instead of putting n square, I can put any power I want. And in fact, there are some results there. Essentially, the problems are all equivalent, I mean, in a certain way. So what can one say in case there is no localization? What can you say about the rate of diffusion when t goes to infinity? What physicists believe is that typically you are not going to have something which is localized, and there will be a slow dispersion. Of course, there are exceptions, and the exceptions are the things you built with KM theory. But typically, you don't have these KM solutions. In you look generically in your phase space, especially with large things, you're not going to have this localization, and then people are expecting a rate of growth of dt, which is a small power of t, most any small power of t, and that seems to be very poorly understood. Since I have to convince you that there is some kind of progress, what one can do, if you want to have a general result on dispersion, a result which would be valid, in fact, not only for the model I was discussing, but more general, short-range, say, bounded-range models, where replace the Qn at the power 4 by a short-range nonlinearity is an estimate, provided you allow a little bit of decay. So we are just taking the linear lattice Schrödinger operator with a random potential, and then we are putting a lambda n. So this is the cheat. Somehow, you can't. This is a good thing about analysis. If you can't solve the problem, you can always twist it a little bit. In that kind of analysis, at least. So I'm going to twist it a little bit. And according to physicists, this is something which is acceptable, is to put some weight factor here, lambda n, which would go to zero quite slowly, but still is going to zero. So then the statement is that they can get what they expect. You can get, in the total general setting, you can get an estimate of your diffusion, dt by t at the power kappa for any kappa. Well, I mean, you have to be careful. So t at the power kappa, and you can choose your kappa as small as you want, provided I will choose provided the epsilon, which is here, which is the factor of the Laplacian, is small enough. I guess you could also, instead of taking epsilon small enough, you could take Vn sufficiently large, but let's say epsilon is small enough. So what is the statement? Take lambda n to decay like 1 over n at the power gamma, and gamma is some fixed positive number as small as you want. Then if I give you a kappa, you can take epsilon sufficiently small to have a rate of diffusion which is less than t at the power kappa. A few comments. Results of that nature were gotten, say, there's a paper by Simon and Cortes. But they only did it for basically perturbations which are rank 1, things like that. Here we're talking about something which is a much broader class. We don't have quite the original problem, but the lambda n's can be any slow decaying sequence. Now, the relation to dynamical systems, what is mainly involved here is Necker-Roches theory. If you know what this is, I may not have the time to go into that today, but basically Necker-Roches theory is some kind of general stability theory for dynamical systems. But Necker-Roches theory only tells you that if you have a small perturbation of something which is linear non-resonant or convex, non-linear convex, integrable, small perturbation is going to give you times which are long depending on this relative to this perturbation. So I have an epsilon perturbation, get a time of stability, say, which is an exponential 1 over epsilon or something like that. Now, here we're talking about something which is slightly different, because we don't have a priori a small perturbation, right? And the times where we have information are all times t going to infinity. So there is an idea there which, in fact, was hinted to in Frederick Spencer Wayne, but they never really worked it out, is to use Necker-Roches theory to construct barriers. And these barriers, of course, depend on the fact of having a random potential. And these barriers are not going, well, I mean, you don't destroy the nonlinearity, the perturbation completely, but you construct certain, say, at certain regions, in certain regions, you manage to destroy enough the perturbation to create some kind of an energy barrier there, which will slow down the flux of the L2 norm to to the sites n for large n, and this is essentially how this result is gotten. So it's kind of an interesting application of Necker-Rochas, because you get a result for all times, just not for a time which is very long. Okay. Well, what I'm doing here is an overview of various of the topics I will talk about later. What is something I have worked quite a bit on, and which relates a lot to the localization problem for lattice Schrödinger operators, lattice Schrödinger equations with the quasi-periodic potential, is the theory of periodic and quasi-periodic solutions in PDEs. So here we are going back to where we started from. So we have a Hamiltonian PDE. We have a Hamiltonian PDE on a bounded domain, say, let's take periodic boundary conditions. But we write it in some specific form, which should be better readable. Let me get something like that. Here we go. Yeah. So essentially, I want to see my equation, just because it suits me better, as a perturbation of either a linear equation, and I should, in fact, say a linear equation with parameters, or a perturbation of a nonlinear integrable equation. So in the first two cases, what you get is a perturbation, a Hamiltonian perturbation, of a linear equation, which is the linear Schrödinger equation, with a potential. I say parameters. Well, the fact of having this potential V of X there allows you to put parameters in the problem. The second case is a similar thing for the wave equation. The last two examples are perturbations. The first is the perturbation of the usual integrable Zakharov-Shabbat model, which is an integrable nonlinear equation. And the last one, of course, is a perturbation of the KdV equation. So if we are taking either the linear equation or the integrable equation, we get a phase space which is foliated in invariant tori. What we want to know with an epsilon perturbation there is whether some of these tori are going to persist up to certain deformation. And so this is a theory. I mean, there are some people that have worked on that, and these are some of them. There is a reasonable theory now. So we are talking here about the behavior, which is certainly not a generic behavior, because small part, at least that's what people expect, small part of phase space is just specific solutions. Here it's really a matter of just constructing solutions which will have a behavior in time which is periodic, which would correspond to one-dimensional tori, quasi-periodic, finite-dimensional tori, almost periodic, infinite dimensional tori, possibly which are of half dimension, say full dimension, which means half dimension, whatever it means, we're in infinite dimension phase space. So there are two theories there. The first theory is that of small solutions, which is the only thing which I really understand well, and which is what I mention you later. And in the small solution case, well, in either you have, well, I'm talking here more about perturbations of integrable equations. The small solution case basically leads to perturbations of linear equations with parameters. If you have large solutions, this thing does not work. And still it's possible to prove results, but it's much heavier because you have to go in basically other sets of coordinates which are adapted to the integrable structure of the underlying integrable equation, and you have to do this analysis on Riemann surfaces, which is definitely much less elementary than simply working with Fourier coefficients. So I will talk to you a little bit about that, and well, there is a reasonable coherent theory in many of the whatever latest tech comes from methods from quasi-periodic localization, in particular the theory of semi-algebraic sets and uniformization of semi-algebraic sets, which makes these things relatively easy. So this is about as technical as the talk is going to come. Let me state you just one kind of model result which is gotten like that, just to give you the flavor, if you don't mind. I'll explain you the statement, which is relatively easy after all. So here we are talking about a perturbation of a linear equation. So the linear equation would be the Schrödinger equation. And since I want parameters, instead of working with Laplacian plus V of X and then looking at the periodic spectrum one Dirichlet periodic spectrum. Instead of working with this Laplacian plus V, let's make the thing simple, and let's just take a Fourier multiplier right away, which is roughly behaving like the Laplacian. So this Fourier multiplier is just acting by Fourier multiplication. The Laplacian would be mn equals n squared, but I want to have some parameters, so I will fix a certain number of modes, n1, n2, and b, say. B is the dimension of the torus, of the invariant torus I want to construct. And then for n in that set, which you could call distinguished modes, let's take your multiplier to be lambda j, where the lambdas, lambda 1, lambda b, is a full b-dimensional parameter. Now, if epsilon is equal to 0, well, then I have a linear equation, and the solution is, of course, obvious to write. In particular, what I can consider are solutions which are living on the modes n1 and b, and which are explicit, say, quasi-periodic solutions, which are sitting here. So the kind of theorem you're getting is the following. Well, you want to see what is going to happen with such solutions if you turn on the perturbation. So you put an epsilon there. Right. So what is happening is that not all of them are going to survive, but still many in the measure sense, and you get the Cantor set, C epsilon, which is going to be almost a full measure. So the measure of that Cantor set goes to 1 when epsilon goes to 0. Now, what it means survive? Well, it means that it's going to be deformed. So first, I have to deform my frequency. So there is a smooth map. In fact, the map is defined on the whole of the parameter space, which is going to change the frequency lambda to a frequency lambda prime. And so going to adjust the frequency. Also, you're going to have to add more modes. In any case, for lambda in C epsilon, you're going to have a quasi-periodic solution, U epsilon, which is close to U zero, say we're in the real analytic category, say, and which is quasi-periodic in time with new frequencies, lambda 1 prime, lambda B prime, where, the U epsilon XT is going to appear as a Fourier series, which is written both in N, which relates to the spatial modes, and in the lambda prime and say K lambda prime in K, say, where the K is going to refer to the time frequencies. Now these results are proven. Well, these results are results, say, of KM type, and they are proven with perturbative techniques. The old-fashioned KM technique being not totally adequate, at least the way it stands for that purpose, the reason being that in these problems you have resonances, especially in higher dimension. If you're looking at Mn, for instance, well, if you fix n squared, you're going to have many sides. So already in dimension 2, and certainly in higher dimension, you're going to have many sides n, for which n squared is going to be a certain value. Essentially, what it corresponds to is to look at lattice points on a sphere, right? So if I take a sphere of radius r, looking at lattice points, basically, for higher dimension, I'm going to have lots of these guys. And this creates resonance problems, which somehow are not too much compatible with classical KM. So the effect of this development, whatever this theory has been, to come up with, I would say, a certain substitute of KM, which mainly go back to the work of Craig and Wayne, which was the simplest case. They're just periodic. But even periodic in one dimension, you have, say, if you look at periodic boundary conditions, you have resonance problems which create a certain difficulty. So you kind of have to come up with alternative schemes, and these alternative schemes are exactly what you may call analogs. I mean, they are very, very close to the problems of quasi-periodic localization for lattice-Schrödinger operators, I was talking about there, and very closely related to understanding Anderson localization in these quasi-periodic models. So the general scheme, is a linearization scheme. So you just solve the problem by a Newton iteration method, which is done also in the usual KN theory, but here I do it directly on the equation. And so basically all the analysis is to understand the linearized equation. So now it's a good nonlinear problem, because the main thing is to understand the linear problem. So this linear problem, you have to understand Green's functions of this linear problem, and this linear problem is essentially the same kind as the one encounters to do quasi-periodic lattice localization. So, in fact, there has been an offspring of that in the classical finite dimensional theory. You see, what is the finite dimensional model case? The usual KM theory deals with persistency of invariant tori, which are of half the dimension of the phase space. So what you could do, what you could look at, are tori which are a little bit smaller. So the model case, which is sometimes called a Melnikov problem, is that you would have a phase space which is dimension 2n. So it would work here in finite dimensions, so take 2n and n is fixed. And I'm trying to prove persistency of tori which are of dimension b, where b is possibly smaller than n. So the way you write, if you're talking about perturbations of linear equations, the simplest way to write it is just, say, you have complex canonical coordinates which are q1, qn, and then you write your equation in the form which is here, where the lambda 1, lambda b are going to be, again, the parameters from before that are used to somehow get through the perturbative scheme and get you persistency of some of these invariant tori. And then you have other frequencies, which are the nu's, nu b plus 1, nu n, which you can call normal frequencies. And this is also a topic people have been looking at. So you have, for epsilon equals 0, you have an obvious solution, an obvious quasi-periodic solution, where the qj's are of amplitude aj for j from 1 up to b, and then you take the others equals 0. I mean, you can write down, obviously, the solution of that. And then again, there is a persistency problem. So this is a question that has been looked at by a number of people. And one of the issues is that the techniques which are going back to the Craig Wayne paper, which is some kind of direct, what you may call a Nash-Moser type of scheme, they allow you to prove persistency without having to require that the normal frequencies are different. So when you, for instance, look at periodic boundary conditions, especially in the higher dimensional case, you're going to have lots of multiplicities there. So you want to have a theorem here in the finite dimensional case that allows multiplicities. So in analogy with the usual KM theory, what I certainly want, but this I can always get, this I can guarantee because my lambda is a full parameter. So what is going to appear are relations of the form k dot lambda, which is k1 lambda 1 plus kb lambda b, and where k is a vector in ZB. So I'm going to have this guy. Now, if you look at it and you would try to construct a solution perturbatively, then you're going to get your small divisors, and these small divisors are going to involve also expressions of the form K lambda plus new something, whatever, new J, for one of these normal frequencies. So you're going to get such guys. But somehow, you're not going to find in your perturbative series expressions which are going to involve differences. Now, the usual KM scheme seems to be sensitive to having distinct new J's, and it turns out that with the present technology, one can prove exactly the same theorems without assuming different normal frequencies. In other words, allowing resonances in these normal frequencies, which is quite important for the PD applications. In other words, this condition here, and of course this, are the only ones which came into the picture. To put it more conceptually, the difference from dynamical systems point of view is that there are techniques to construct, to show persistency of invariant tori that may have positive exponents. As soon as you have possible multiplicities in these normal frequencies, you could have positive exponents. So essentially the conditions of stability which appear are those which you just expect. What? I haven't worked on that for a long, long time. I'm just repeating what you told me, basically. So, no, I mean, obviously one could have positive exponents on that. But I believe that you did one. Okay, one. But if you have one, you could have... But you can push that. I mean, it's clear. I don't know how far you could... There are a few other developments. What I mentioned to you earlier is Necker-Roche stability. So basically, what is Necker-Roche stability? You have, well, I mean, essentially there are two versions. There is a baby version, then there is some version which is more sophisticated, but the idea is that you would have either a linear non-resonant system, and then you want to see how solutions of this linear system are going to persist, are going to remain more or less what they are, if you put a non-linear small perturbation, or what you can have, again, this is in analogy with the KM type of questions, you could have an integrable system with a nonlinear, so a nonlinear equation that with an integrable Hamiltonian, which is convex or quasi-convex, and see what are the stability properties of solutions, quasi-periodic solutions, if you turn on a small perturbation. So the first kind of phenomenon, I believe, is sometimes called quasi-Necker-Roche. The second one is the full Necker-Roche, where you have a convex or a quasi-convex Hamiltonian, which is not necessarily quadratic, and you want to see what happens with perturbations. So let's get to specifics here. Let's just talk about finite dimension, but probably high dimension. So the first case of perturbing a linear system, so what they call quasi-Necker-Roche, is that you would take a Hamiltonian which is linear in the action variables. So you have some lambda j ij. Ij is basically qj squared, where the lambdas are Diophantine. And then you put a small perturbation, epsilon, and you want to see some kind of stability of the action variables for long times. Long times meaning that it's much more than 1 over epsilon. And in fact, in that kind of context, you would take log of the epsilon. which is like a power of 1 over epsilon, but you could do for more modest. Essentially, everything which is significantly below 1 over epsilon is already a non-trivial time of stability. So anyway, the other case of convex Hamiltonians would be to, well, you can add also the linear part, to take an expression which is convex in the IJs. So you would take some IJ square, say, or quasi-convex. For some reason, people like quasi-convex because it allows you to consider non-autonomous Hamiltonians with the time. So you would add, say, I0. Quasi-convex means that you have your convexity property which is satisfied. So you write the second derivative and you have your usual inequality which is satisfied for vectors which are perpendicular on the gradient. So again, you can put on a perturbation and see what is the stability of the action variable. Now, the classical theorem there, Nekorotchev, gives you stability times in a fixed dimension d, which are going to be at least the logarithm of 1 over, sorry, the logarithm of the time is going to be a small power of 1 over epsilon, and that power depends on d, and people have, in fact, worked on that, and several results. In particular, there is an estimate sigma like 1 over d, an estimate from below, and an estimate maybe 1 over 2d. I mean, it's not really important. Above, particularly there is work of Marco Sauzin in this connection. They have done it in the Gevrey class. And now the point I want to make is that if you want to use such a theory, I'm going to stop soon. If you want to make such a theory for PDEs, the thing you have to understand, of course, is the role of this dimension. Now, the D is the dimension of, half the dimension of the phase space. Of course, you could try to cheat on that, and instead of taking phase space, you could start from an unperturbed torus, which lies in low dimension, and prove its stability for a long time. So, to a certain extent, the dimension of the phase space can be basically replaced by the dimension of the underlying unperturbed torus. But what I want to say is that when you're looking at such an estimate, the immediate... So, I mean, these are theorems which are true in analytic, and in fact they have been pushed in Gevrey. The reason why they were looked at in Gevrey is that they were counterexamples, at least examples showing that you couldn't do better, and these examples could only be produced in the Gevrey class. That's why they wanted to do Gevrey. So first you have to show that the same results hold in Gevrey to modify the counterexample. Anyway, so when you're looking at this formula, it doesn't look very promising, right? Because as soon as the sigma is like 1 over log 1 over epsilon, so if you put your d like log of 1 over epsilon, you're basically dead because you don't get anything. So that doesn't look so good if you, for instance, think in terms of planetary dynamics, right? So you have the sun and then you have the planets around, so you just take an unperturbed system, which means mutual attraction of sun and the planets. You ignore the attraction between the planets, then you turn on a perturbation, epsilon. Now, as soon as you have 27 planets, well, just calculate what it means. You cannot just do stability just from a qualitative Nekorotchev point of view, because this whatever perturbations that are coming from the epsilon, which are coming from the attractions between the planets, is going to exceed by far the exponential in minus 27. So this theorem doesn't look so good. So question is whether there is something more there or not. And somehow, first thing one would like to do is to find perhaps a new proof of Nekorotchev, which would go beyond these dimensional restrictions, perhaps with a theorem which is much weaker. So actually, they were quite optimistic about that, but what it turns out, this is some recent work which is still in progress I have with Kaloshin, is that unfortunately, what is there, and there is nothing more to it. In other words, you can make examples in the analytic category where you see that with a dimension, say, which is d, and a perturbation which is as small as an exponential in minus d, you're basically not getting better than obvious stability times which are like 1 over epsilon. Nevertheless, there are results. And there are results which were, in fact, these results were already there earlier. There are a certain number of instances where one can do better. So what I said is that this is the example if you are in the full generality of real analytic perturbation. Now, one can be more specific. One way to be specific is to consider, for instance, bounded range perturbations, like in the spirit of the coupled harmonic oscillators, the Laforet expands, etc. And that gives you better. Another way to do it is to work with polynomials which are of bounded degree. Then one also gets better. So there has been a number of applications of Necker-Rochev, especially quasi-convex Necker-Rochev in PDEs, that go beyond this barrier here, but they always appeared with certain specifics on the nonlinearities, and somehow was not really clear what was really the importance of the structure of the nonlinearity. So at least what it turns out with that kind of example is that you have to involve this structure, because if you just play in the full generality of real analytic potential, you get a blockage there and you're not going to go beyond the dimension which is like the logarithm of one of the perturbations, and one has to put structure. Of what? Yeah, no, but I would keep stiffness. You see, the problem is to fabricate. I mean, if you're trying to make. Yeah. The problem is to make examples here. Because the trouble is, if you want to show that something is going to drift, you need to have a tool. You need to have a tool to control a solution. Now, essentially, how do you control a solution? Well, the obvious way is to control it perturbatively. But perturbatively means that you're going to do some kind of KM or God knows what. But you are exactly trying to get a drift. So it is not compatible of the things you get by KM. So you need to have another method to control solutions which are not KM methods. So there are two ways. I mean, basically there are two approaches. There is one approach which is some kind of a use of the Schroeder fixed-point theorem to create resonance. So what you do is that you start with parameters, then you construct something at the end. I like to show that you have to make a drift. I want to create a resonance. So somehow, to create a resonance, I reintroduce my sequence to get that resonance, and then I get the coincidence using a Schroeder fixed-point argument. This is very vague, right? Then there is another method which I'm probably much more familiar with, which is the Matter method, which is a variational method. So you have a hypothetical trajectory, somehow common sense telling you that your new solution is going to have to drift because all the evidence somehow is that it has to go like that. But then still, you have to prove that there is a real solution where you expect the solution to be. And this is done by variational method. So this is a method that goes to Matter. This is another way, basically, Kaloshin presented that kind of thing. But essentially the conclusion is the same, is that when the dimension is sufficiently large, you can create very long, basically very long periodic trajectories and a drift along these trajectories, and to get this drift, one or another method gets you that. But still, there is hope to get more, and this is not certainly very fast understood, possibility to get beyond that if you specify the non-linearities like you can often do. So I think I did about my time, right? If I have some more time, I'll continue, but I guess it's about it for